all over the world at this present time, special events in World War II naval history are being marked by 50th anniversaries. This has created memorable interest by the younger generation, whose fathers or grandfathers lived through that appalling war, which resulted in the annihilation of almost 60 million people. A war which, by the demonic powers of one man, Adolf Hitler, plunged the world into a nightmare of terror and misery. The battles listed in the accompanying leaflet cover the first group of actions recorded onto audio cassettes taken from the author's present series of lectures on World War II naval history. This audio cassette concerns the events in the Second War relating to the memorable and gallant action by the cruiser HMS Exeter in the Battle of the River Plate, when even the commanding officer of the enemy ship was compelled to say, "When you fight brave men like that, you only want to shake hands with them." The date was the 13th of December 1939. The ship, the cruiser HMS Exeter. The place, a few hundred miles off the coast of South America, somewhere east of the River Plate. At 0600 on that beautiful morning, with clear vision from horizon to horizon, a lookout, peering through a bridge telescope, excitedly reported, "Smoke on the horizon, sir." And only seconds later, "It's a battleship, sir, a pocket battleship." That report was the prelude to the first and one of the most gallant battles in the Royal Naval history in World War II, the Battle of the River Plate. To understand the background of this epic engagement, and indeed of all the naval actions during those 5 years of bitter war, it's necessary to go back in time a little to the end of the First World War. In 1918, when Germany sailed her fleet into Scapa Flow under the terms of surrender, she scuttled every ship in defiance. Great Britain was war-weary, bankrupt, and not too upset with this event, for with the German Navy now presenting no danger, it was thought that peace would reign supreme for many, many years, and that Germany would never rise again as a warring nation. However, hardly had these ships settled on the seabed than moves were already afoot in Germany to rearm. Under the terms of the Versailles Treaty and the London Naval Conference, Germany was forbidden to build any capital ships over 10,000 tons. Undaunted by these restrictions, Germany set about secretly building 12,000-ton pocket battleships, which finished up at 13,000 tons. Eventually, ignoring all limitations, Hitler went on to construct between 1934 and 39 two battle cruisers of 32,000 tons, two fast battleships of 43,000 tons, five heavy cruisers of 14,000 tons, and the construction of many submarines and destroyers. By clever thinking in production and design, the pocket battleships were able to carry six 11-inch guns, eight 6-inch with 4-inch armor plating, a speed of 26 knots, and had a range of 15,000 miles. And while between 1953 and the outbreak of war in September 1939, prime ministers like Stanley Baldwin and Neville Chamberlain preached appeasement and practiced disarmament, it was clear to all except the mentally handicapped that war with Germany was inevitable. The reason being that by 1938, Germany had 3 million men under arms, an air force, the Luftwaffe of over 5,000 aircraft, and was building at the rate of 1,000 per month. No country threatened her. No country was in a position to do so. And while Winston Churchill begged and pleaded with the government for Great Britain to rearm as quickly as possible to defend herself in the face of this threatening situation. He was held down and accused of being a warmonger. And although Britain had a commanding lead in the number of warships, this advantage was narrowed by her global commitments. Britain had an empire over 13 million square miles and responsible for 450 million people. Her sea lanes for supplies were her lifeline, and she was committed to preserving that lifeline of convoys in wartime in the North Atlantic, South Atlantic, and the Arctic Ocean, the Mediterranean, and the Far East. Also, many of her battleships were old, outdated, being built as far back as 1914. Even before Britain and France had declared war on Germany on the 3rd of September 1939, German High Command had secretly sailed two pocket battleships, the Graf Spee and the Deutschland, into the North and South Atlantic respectively. To introduce the principal characters involved in this confrontation in the South Atlantic, on the German side, under the German leader Adolf Hitler, was the Commander-in-Chief of German Naval Command, Admiral Erich Raeder, and on the British side, the First Sea Lord, Admiral Sir Dudley Pound, with his Commander-in-Chief of the Home Fleet, Admiral Sir John Tovey. Graf Spee sailed from Wilhelmshaven on the 21st of August 1939, 2 full weeks before war was declared. With her went the notorious supply ship Altmark, designed to roam around the South Atlantic, always available to Graf Spee for oil, food, and other supplies. Graf Spee's mandate from Admiral Raeder was to sweep the South Atlantic, raiding and destroying the convoy shipping. She was also directed to avoid confrontation with Allied warships, keep out of trouble, and keep switching areas of action, thus forcing the Allies to provide heavy surface forces to protect every convoy, and thus weaken the power of the Royal Navy. With no declaration of war, Graf Spee had an easy access into the Atlantic and passed quietly through the passage between the Faroe Islands and Iceland into the center of the North Atlantic, down past the Azores, past the equator, into the South Atlantic, past Ascension Island, circled around in the middle of the South Atlantic, and then headed west to the Brazilian coast off Pernambuco, and there sank the British liner Clement on the 30th September. Avoiding staying in that area too long, the commanding officer of Graf Spee, Captain Hans Langsdorff, switched operations east and crossed over to the island of St. Helena, and there, on the 8th of October, sank the freighters Newton Beach and Ashley. 9 days later, he was back in the center area, and there sank the Huntsman on the 17th of October. He now crossed over to the coast of southwest Africa and 5 days later sank the Tivani. During all these acts of piracy, most of the captured crews from the Allied ships were transferred to the notorious German supply ship Altmark, and there herded into the hold like cattle. Some were sent off in boats and took days to reach shore, more dead than alive. Once ashore, however, the details of their sinkings were reported to Admiralty, and the hunt began to capture this pirate of the South Atlantic. And before this cycle was over, Altmark would have 300 prisoners. Clearly avoiding any sea traffic along the African coast, Graf Spee moved back into the center of the ocean, and then came around the Cape of Good Hope, moved up the east coast of Africa, and there sank the Africa Shell. Not much satisfaction for Langsdorff, however, for the tanker Africa Shell was empty. And when Graf Spee ordered the ship to stop, Captain Dove, the skipper of Africa Shell, tried to beach the ship on the nearby shore. A couple of shells from Grass Bay soon stopped that, and they had to surrender. The crew scrambled into boats and rowed for the shore 2.5 miles only distant, and the Germans came aboard and blew up the ship. Captain Dunn was brought aboard Grass Bay as a prisoner, but was treated by Langsdorff almost as a guest. He apologized to Captain Dove for sinking his ship, but explained that this was war. Langsdorff was a very human man and a gentleman, slim, fair hair, and although Captain Dove had to be kept confined, he was treated with the utmost courtesy. Of all the ships that were sunk, some were able to transmit their position before they went down. Langsdorff was such a humanitarian that he would radio the nearest shore base, asking lifeboats to come out and rescue the survivors. As far as the Admiralty was concerned, the situation had become serious, and desperate measures had to be taken. As a result, the Admiralty formed hunting groups. Grass Bay had to be destroyed. One group comprised the battle cruiser Renown, with the aircraft carrier Ark Royal working from Freetown in Sierra Leone, another, two heavy cruisers and the aircraft carrier Hermes from Dakar in Senegal, another, the two heavy cruisers Sussex and Shropshire based at Cape Town. On the other side of the South Atlantic was Commodore Harwood's group comprising the 8-inch gun cruiser Exeter and the 6-inch cruisers Ajax and Achilles, while the heavy cruiser Cumberland was stationed at the Falklands. In the meantime, Grass Bay had moved back into the South Atlantic and sunk two more merchant ships on the 2nd and 3rd of December, the Tiora and the Doric Star. Their crews to the Altmark, their officers to join Captain Dove in Grass Bay. Langsdorff now decided that he would have better pickings if he made his way across to South America and there raid and sink the rich supply ships coming out of the River Plate estuary. It was the most fateful decision of his life. Having made his last rendezvous with the Altmark and having sunk one more Allied ship, the Strinshaw, mid-Atlantic, he made for Montevideo. By now, he had sunk a total of 50,000 tons of shipping. Ever since Commodore Harwood had been assigned the special duty of protecting British shipping off the coast of South America between the River Plate and Rio de Janeiro, about 3,000 square miles, he was convinced that sooner or later, Grass Bay would head for the Plate estuary. From the distress call from the last ship to be sunk, the Strinshaw, he calculated, and quite correctly, that Grass Bay would arrive off the estuary by the 13th of December. By the 12th of December, Harwood, flying his flag in the cruiser Ajax, commanded by Captain Woodhouse, in company with the 8-inch cruiser Exeter, commanded by Captain Bell, and the 6-inch cruiser Achilles, Captain Parry, was patrolling about 200 miles to seaward and waiting. On that morning of the 13th, the flagship, the cruiser Ajax, was leading the Achilles with Exeter in the rear. A beautiful morning with the sea clear from horizon to horizon. Commodore Harwood on the bridge was restless, certain in mind that today they would meet the Grass Bay, and everyone told to keep his eyes skinned. At 0600, one of the lookouts reported, "Smoke on the horizon, sir." Only seconds later, confirmation it was a pocket battleship. Immediately, all ships hoisted their battle ensigns, and action stations were sounded. In each ship, turrets were swung around, while shells were rammed into breaches, the cordite charges inserted, the breech doors slammed, and the guns trained on the target, waiting for the order to fire. All ships were now heading straight for the enemy at top speed. The three approaching British ships were, of course, sighted by Grouse Bay. But whether the commanding officer, Captain Langsdorff, interpreted the distant mass as a small convoy or as one light cruiser and two destroyers is uncertain. But whatever the explanation, he came straight on. Hitler's orders were to avoid battle at all times. But as he came closer, he realized his mistake, for here, clearly, was the outline of the 8-inch gun cruiser Exeter, followed by two smaller cruisers. They were now on a closing speed of almost 60 miles an hour, but Langsdorff couldn't do anything about it because he had committed himself. Perhaps, if he had retreated, he could have destroyed his pursuers with the power of his 11-inch guns from astern before they could catch up with him. His best speed was 26 knots, and that of Exeter, 32 knots. Now Langsdorff could do nothing but head straight on. Harwood's battle orders in such an emergency had been made very clear. Attack and engage on both flanks. Accordingly, Captain Bell of Exeter turned to the west to attack from a southwest direction, while Ajax, Captain Woodhouse, and Achilles, Captain Parry, swung northeast across the line of the approaching enemy. By this maneuver, Grouse Bay had to divide her forward triple turret gunfire between the two opposing forces. As both sides opened fire, the distance was about 12 miles. On Ajax's catapult deck, the little Seafire aircraft, destined to be used as a spotter plane to register the fall of shot, stood ready. Whether the plane could be launched was another thing, for nearby X and Y turrets at the stern had swung their guns around so that the blast from the six 6-inch guns was shaking the plane to bits. The two pilots were Lewin and Kearney, with their engines revving, waiting to take off. They had only 12 seconds between each blast of gunfire from these guns to take off and avoid being shot down. The turrets had been swung around for broadsides and were dangerously close to the catapult. However, as the last broadside fired, the catapult fired and the aircraft roared off, airborne safely. But now, Grouse Bay was concentrating all her firepower on the 8-inch cruiser Exeter, knowing she was the greatest danger. The first hit amidships killed all the torpedo crew on the starboard side. Another hit the forecastle, ripping the deck apart. Despite these hits, Exeter ran on and on, trying to get nearer to the German to inflict greater damage on Grouse Bay with her own shells, and several of these caused much destruction. More trouble came when another enemy shell hit Exeter's forward B turret, manned by the Royal Marines, killing all the turret crew. A moment later, another shell fell behind B turret, exploded, and scattered the bridge in hot shrapnel. As Captain Bell recovered consciousness, he found that everyone had been killed except himself and the messenger boy, Roper. Bell was hit in the head with splinters in both eyes. All this time, Exeter was still firing and scoring hits. Another salvo of shells from Grouse Bay destroyed the wheelhouse, and the main steering gear was put out of action. Clambering over the wreckage, Bell ran the gauntlet of shrapnel and exploding shells to reach the conning position aft, close to the mainmast. He then organized a chain of men along the deck to the after steering position to pass his orders. And this was how the ship was steered until the end of the engagement. At these times, I think I can truthfully say There is no hatred of the enemy. Knowledge is the forerunner of hatred, and you have no personal knowledge of the men who are trying to kill you. But there is one simple equation to all, and it is that if you don't kill the enemy, he will kill you. War is an evil, obscene ingredient of man's existence, whereby millions of peace-loving people who would not normally hurt a fly are trained in the art of killing and are thrown into a vast battle arena with the object of murdering one another. And however reluctant the combatants may be, in the heat of confrontation, options are non-existent. There is one law only: kill or be killed. In such circumstances, there are few disputes and no slackers. Every man does his job with all the strength and energy he can muster. He has to, for each man fights for his own survival and for the survival of the ship which keeps him afloat. Please turn this audio cassette over to the beginning of side 2.